This is the Marketplace Morning Report. I'm David Brancaccio.
Another major story we've been following this week, the U.S. Department of Labor's new rules to encourage financial advisors, especially stockbrokers working on commission, to put the client's interest first when it comes to retirement money. The U.S. Secretary of Labor, Thomas Perez, came into Marketplace's L.A. studio to take some questions. Secretary Perez, thank you for joining us.
Great to be with you, David.
We have to see if you and I can get through this interview without using that dreary-sounding word, fiduciary. But remind us briefly what the problem is that you're trying to solve.
We're trying to make sure that financial advisors act like lawyers and doctors. When you go to a lawyer or a doctor, they have an obligation to put your best interests first. Financial advisors don't. And what we did the other day, quite simply, was take the marketing materials of so many of the companies that say we put our client first, and we said, it's a great slogan, it's now the law.
The system seems, I don't know, a little mushy in parts. A broker can recommend his or her firm's financial products if the broker is reasonably sure it's a better deal than the competitors. But you wonder how that's actually going to go in real life, making that decision of, yeah, we really offer a better deal.
Well, people talk a lot about the issue of access to advice. Why don't more people get advice? And part of the reason that we've learned from the work that we have done is that a lot of people don't trust the advisors. They have reason not to trust them because the system was structurally flawed. And we are correcting that misalignment. And I am confident that what we have done in this rule is going to enhance trust. And therefore, more people, when they are empowered, will then seek access.
We've heard on this program that some companies might get out of the brokerage business, no longer do work on commission and switch over to the annual fee arrangements. Are you worried about consumers not having the choice that they need?
There are a number of people out there already in the business of giving advice who use the fiduciary model. In 2007, the certified financial planners changed their model. These are people who provide advice. And in 2007, they decided that they were going to adopt the fiduciary model. The critics predicted, oh my God, there'd be so many less certified financial planners because they're using this higher standard. It's gone up like 35%. And then secondly, one of the most frequent sets of feedback I've heard in the comment process, David, is from people who are already working under the fiduciary model. But let me rephrase that because you told me I couldn't use the word fiduciary. People who are already putting their clients' best interests first. And what they tell me is this: hey, Tom, these companies who are threatening to pull out, can you do me a favor? Can you give them my email and my phone number? Because I'm doing good and I'm doing well. And it is a completely false choice to suggest that the only way that a financial advisor can make a living is on the backs of their consumers. That is the quintessential false choice. Doing well and doing good are not only compatible, but when you do good, you in fact do even better.
I don't want to get too technical on this question, but I was curious. There are these Tom Perez rules governing these conflicts of interest we've been talking about, but I don't think the story ends there. This, what, the Securities and Exchange Commission will also have some rules soon?
Well, we have complementary jurisdictions. We enforce the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, or ERISA. That's the Department of Labor's responsibility. The Securities and Exchange Commission has other responsibilities, and it will be up to them to figure out what to do. Chair White has indicated that she believes the best interest standard is the appropriate standard, and I'm hopeful that they will follow suit, because what's interesting to me is to look at least the preliminary feedback we've gotten in the aftermath of the publication of our rule. We had many, many constructive conversations with folks in the industry. And I was heartened to see companies like Bank of America and Merrill Lynch saying, this is the right standard. They told us in our feedback with them and in our conversations, they told us the following: we agree with your North Star, an enforceable best interest standard. We think you should trim the sails. We think you should do a number of things that will make that North Star better, but also make it more workable. We listened, we acted, and I'm heartened to see at least the preliminary actions from folks is that they know that we listened because they can see it in the final rule.
So it sounds like the overall public interest in changing the rules is try to help people have more money for retirement, but how about this one? This is not my idea, but it never seems to pass into U.S. law. if employees in America were to automatically get signed up to save some of their paycheck every month when they're hired, even if they could opt out if they didn't want to save that way, you've probably seen the studies. A lot of money would get saved in America for retirement.
Well, that is another element of the president's plan to strengthen and fortify the retirement pillar of middle-class security. Because you're absolutely right. The studies show that when you have these so-called auto-enrollment features, so somebody starts a job, they automatically are enrolled. They can opt out if they don't want to, but the studies show that workers are something like 12 times more likely to enroll. And I applaud states like California, Illinois, Oregon, and others who have put in place under state law these sort of arrangements. The president has tried in something like the last four or five budgets to do this at a federal level. The Republican Congress has refused to go along with it. I think they, again, have made a big mistake there, because retirement security is at the heart of what it means to be middle class in America. And too many people are up at night, understandably, because that pillar has been frayed as a result of the recession and other forces.
Let's talk about the minimum wage. California is now set to go up to $15 an hour. New York is doing this. The classic argument against is that companies will employ fewer workers if wages have to go up like this. I saw you, though, Secretary Perez, on The Daily Show. You don't buy that argument?
I don't buy that argument. That's correct. The minimum wage was enacted under the following value proposition. Nobody who works a full-time job in this country should have to live in poverty. And across this country today, as a result of the fact that the minimum wage at a federal level has 25% less purchasing power than it had in 1968, we have people working a 40-hour week and getting their food at the food pantry. That's not who we are as a nation. That is bad for workers. It's bad for families. It's bad for business, because 70% of GDP is consumption. And I can't tell you the number of businesses, David, when I ask the question, what can we do to help? What do you need to grow further? And their answer is, I need customers. Henry Ford understood that over 100 years ago when he doubled the wages of people on the assembly line. And we need Henry Ford economics. And it's unfortunate, because the minimum wage has always been a bipartisan issue in Congress until the Tea Party hijacked this Republican Congress in recent years. Every president except two since FDR has signed an increase in the minimum wage. And when I worked for Senator Kennedy in 96, he was working with Newt Gingrich and Bill Clinton, and they were able to raise the minimum wage in a presidential election year. Unfortunately, this Republican Congress and even some Republican candidates for president have said a low minimum wage is not a bad thing for America. I couldn't disagree more with that proposition.
I know, but you don't have to be with the Tea Party to know that it's a little bit complicated. I saw comments by the CEO of the Sonic hamburger chain. Apparently, he has 3,000 locations. He doesn't think he'll cut employment with higher minimum wage, but he thinks he'll have to raise prices for the burgers and the fries. Now, see, the argument is that inflation might kick in, eroding these minimum wage increases. What do you think?
Well, if the price of a burger goes up 5 cents, and the minimum wage that you have received is going up from $7.25 to $15, and there have been a number of studies that document how much they think the price of a burger might go up if you increase the minimum wage, you match the costs and the benefits, and the benefits far outweigh the costs.
All right. So there could be some inflation, but do the math, and you think it's going to be, in the end, net positive for the worker with the raise.
You know what's interesting, David, is you look at places like Shake Shack, and don't tell my wife I go there, and don't tell the First Lady. But I'll tell you, Shake Shack is one of the most successful IPOs over the last couple of years. And they have demonstrated that you can run a burger business in which you sell a great product and you treat your workers well. And I spoke to the founder of Shake Shack, and he told me that the key to their success was that they paid well above the minimum wage, because what that did is it produced a loyal and productive workforce and less attrition. That's what it's about. And this issue has been studied and studied to death. And the calamity howlers, as FDR called them, they continue to make the same old tired claims. The reason people are so angry in this country is because we are out of balance as a nation. And the reason why states like South Dakota and Arkansas, Alaska, red states, are passing minimum wage initiatives overwhelmingly is because the people around this country, red states, blue states alike, they know what the Republican leadership in Congress has refused to acknowledge, that when you work a full day's pay, you ought to get a good wage when you do that. That's what it's all about.
Let's talk about who gets overtime in America. The cutoff has been around 23 grand. Many jobs, if you made more than that, you were exempt from getting paid overtime. Now, your administration is moving to raise that this summer, right?
Yes, the president directed us to address the fact that the overtime rule was frankly diluted in 2004 by a regulation put in place by the Bush administration. When you work extra, you should be paid extra. That's what the Fair Labor Standards Act said. And I met so many people who are working 60, 70 hours a week, and they're effectively working 20 hours for free because they're making a little bit above the minimum wage because the 2004 regulation enables employers to do that. That's not fair. The president said to fix it, and we're going to fix it.
I mean, there's some question about that, right? It's all about timing. Congress could get involved. There is opposition to this. Do you think we'd see this in the remainder of this administration?
We will finish this rule.
All right. So I'll be watching, and I'm sure people who are not getting overtime are going to be watching.
There's a remarkable discussion going on around this country, David, about wage inequality and wage stagnation. We've made tremendous progress in recovering from the worst recession of our lifetime. But we have unfinished business. And a big part of the unfinished business is to make sure that the wind that's at our back, that's resulted in 73 consecutive months of private sector job growth to the tune of over 14 million jobs, results in shared prosperity. The rising tide needs to lift all the boats and not just the yachts. And that is why we work so hard to lift the minimum wage. That's why we're making sure that people who work overtime get paid overtime. That's why we're investing in skills, because one of the best ways to get a better wage is to get more skills. And it's remarkable to me that when we have the unfinished business of wage stagnation, the folks who talk about it do nothing about it. And that is incredibly frustrating. The American people want action, and this president has delivered action, and we will continue to deliver action to help working families.
Now, before we go, you know the work of Kurt Vonnegut, the author and social critic, right?
I've heard of him.
Yes. Well, late in Vonnegut's life, I was able to interview him on TV, and he suggested that what this country needs, he said to me, is a cabinet-level person to worry about the next generation. He called it a secretary of the future. What do you think? Someone on that cabinet to goad the rest of you into longer-term thinking?
Well, we spend a lot of time right now talking about the future of work. And in fact, we had a future of work summit last December at the Department of Labor, because the future of work is quite different, but some of the core principles are the same. They're timeless. People who work a full-time job in this country should make a decent wage, should be able to provide a roof for their family, health care, retirement security. And that's what we talked about. In this gig economy, how do we make sure we continue to abide by these timeless principles, the better bargain for America?
That is one of the great challenges in the future, right? If all the jobs are Uber jobs, that may create opportunities but other problems.
Well, we are having a conversation right now about what the Social Compact 2.0 looks like. And one of the most remarkably important additions to the Social Compact 2.0 is the Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act enables people to go from job to job. It's eliminated the job lock. And the irony of the Republican opposition to the Affordable Care Act is they want to help people become more flexible in the jobs that they would take on. And the Affordable Care Act is a linchpin to that, and yet they can't get over their reflexive ideological opposition to it.
Tom Perez, U.S. Secretary of Labor, thank you very much.
Thank you.